and unsurpassed, penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Good evening, welcome. I'd like to bring up the topic tonight of karma, classic Buddhist topic. We often bring up the Zen stories, which sometimes demonstrate the teachings of Buddha Dharma in that kind of classical sense, but sometimes we may miss in our Zen storytelling some of these essential teachings of the tradition that Zen is based on. And karma is a big one. In a way, very, very simple, but also very profound as something to contemplate and examine in our own life. And as you may imagine, it's happening right now. Karma. Probably for each one of us, there's some karmic activity happening at this moment. And karma also ties into these interesting discussions of free will versus determinism. You know, what is liberation, rebirth? Maybe we can steer clear of that one, but maybe not. So let's look at it a little bit tonight. Vast topic, but we can unpack it a little bit. So, karma.
Do you need more light?
This is okay. Karma in Sanskrit was a term before the Buddha lived, and literally means action or activity, particularly intentional activity. Pretty straightforward. Any intentional activity that we do is what we call karma. So in modern America, it's almost gotten into our kind of slang usage of, you know, somebody has an accident and they always say, oh, they must have bad karma, or like, you know, we don't find a parking spot, I guess it's my bad karma. So it's not quite exactly the right usage. We might say that, like, not finding the parking spot might have to do with the effect of past karma in some way. But karma is more like the cause rather than the effect. Intentional action. And the Buddha said, what is karma? He said, it's intention. Chetana is another Sanskrit word that he used to define karma. Intention or volition or will. And karma can take these three forms of mental karma, which is just the intention itself, and then also the manifestation of the mental intention in the form of speech or physical activity. So we have body, speech, and mind karma. We do intentional activities with body, speech, and mind, don't we? And there are activities, actions of body in particular, and speech and mind, maybe less so with speech, but we could probably think of examples that are not karmic because they're not intentional. Like when you go to the doctor and they look for that spot to test your reflexes, they hit your knee with a hammer and your leg goes up, that's a bodily action, right? Bodily activity, but it's not intentional. You don't have to decide to do that. And same with like our heart beating is not karmic activity. It's just it's a physical action, and breath is a physical action, but not karmic. Our heart rate going up, or controlling our breathing, for example, we could say it could be karmic. But there's actions of a human, of a sentient being, because that's the beings that have intentions are sentient beings. We say that usually, like plants don't have intentions, as far as we can see. Now there may be some very very subtle intentions of plants. I mean, they do turn towards the sun, but as far as we know, they don't. That's not like they're deciding exactly to do that. So does that make sense? Intentional actions of body, speech, and mind are karma. And they also get classified in terms of like wholesome or unwholesome, because it's a big part of how karma works, is that wholesome actions of body, speech, and mind lead to more pleasant results. This may be a common sense truth in this world. We often see it works that way. And most spiritual traditions remind us of this obvious truth. Be kind to others and you'll be happier and they'll be happier. So greed, hate, and delusion, certain kinds of karma come out of those three. Non-greed, non-hate, and non-delusion also produce different kinds of karma. Different kinds of karmic effects. Right? So the karma is like the action, and every karmic action, the Buddha said, has an effect. And this is part of the amazing thing, is that like even every thought, every intentional thought has an effect. Every, if I decide to just kind of move the paper over here, that has an effect. Anything that we do with intention or volition has an effect. So a big part of practice is to basically watch that, study that, examine this process of basically pay attention to what we're doing and notice the effects of what we're doing, which is pretty simple on the surface, pretty straightforward, but hard to do a lot of the time, hard to remember to do that. We like to just kind of do karmic activity and not pay attention so much to the effects. So it's a important and challenging teaching to watch more and more carefully that all the effects of all our thoughts, speech, and actions. Often we don't see all the effects, but just to watch the process. We could even say that Zazen is a practice of examining karma or attending to karma, being present with our intentions, being present with what's happening in general. So sometimes we just attend to our breath. It's not really attending to karma. But a lot of what we might attend to in zazen is karmic activity. If there's some karmic activity going on while we're sitting, then zazen instruction would be to notice that, pay attention to that, notice how, oh, there's an intention to want to move now. And let's see how that intention plays out. Oh, I just moved. There was the effect of that intention. Came very quickly. Or it built up over several minutes. So watching this process with as calmly and as possible, and without, ideally just as an observer, without adding a whole bunch of extra karmic stuff to the process of watching it, which gets really confusing, as we know. So another part of karma here, and this is my understanding of karma at the present time, is that when we say intentional action, it means like from the intention of a sentient being that kind of perceives themselves as a sentient being and as a particular me. So a sense of like that there's somebody here doing the action. My current understanding is that that's part of what we mean by karma. There's a sense of a self that's doing something. So that's why, like, you might be just sitting zazen, not without that sense of a self doing something, and that breathing is happening, and there's maybe even mental activity happening, like noticing. You know, you could be noticing the sound of a bird, and without a sense of, oh, I'm noticing the sound of a bird. There's just the sound coming in. So that noticing is therefore not an intentional activity. Now, if we try to, if we say, now I'm going to pay attention to all the sounds, then now it's a karmic activity. Does that make sense? It could be very subtle, but it involves some form of the kind of view that I am doing this activity, this mental, verbal, or physical activity.
The word control in there somewhere?
That I'm, in control of the activity. Well, control is maybe another word also for intention, volition, or will, is like the sense that I'm in control. So part of the Buddha's teaching is that that's really like an illusion, that there's an actor. We say there's actions happening, but and we very strongly have this sense that there's somebody doing them. But the Buddha's teaching is, if you really look for that one, you'll find all these different mental factors, these different aspects of mind that are constantly arising and ceasing and changing, but you won't find like the doer itself. So one of the things you find if you try to look for a doer is you can find intention. It's called a mental factor. In Buddhist teaching, it's one aspect of the mind. Many of you have heard the teaching of the five skandhas, the five aggregates of experience. When we look for this doer, we will say, "Well, is it a body? Well, is it form or the physical body? That's not it." But that's one thing we find when we start looking. We find sensations of pleasant and unpleasant. We find a conceptual labeling of objects. We find consciousness of external objects. And we find, we call karmic tendencies, like all these different conditioned mental factors that don't fit into those other four aggregates. And we might even say the main one, or the most maybe dominant mental factor in this list of karmic formations is intention. So there is an intention, it's just an arising and ceasing conditioned phenomena. It's not a independent, unchanging self. And I think this in itself, if you catch that teaching, or you maybe have heard before, it's one of the most profound teachings of Buddha Dharma. We think that I think that I do things, but actually there's an intention that is kind of deciding to do things, but the intention is just a conditioned mental factor. It's not that I decide, you could say it's intention decides. And what is that intention? Well, it's a mental factor that's conditioned by past intentions, that we're conditioned by past intentions and conditioned by other things also as well as intentions, but it's all just conditioning all the way back. So therefore, we can't actually find like a fixed doer. But we usually do think that there's a fixed doer, and when we think that there's a fixed, like a self that does things, the karmic effect, the result of all our actions, is like that same self. And isn't that how it seems to work for us? Like, I pick up this paper here, and then I put it down over here, and now it has an effect that I can see it over on this side. It has an effect for me. Or like, you know, that's maybe a very small activity. Say like, you know, I yell at someone, and then the next day they don't want to talk to me anymore. Right? So that's like, I feel like they believe that I'm the one. I'm the same self that yelled at them, and I also believe I'm the same self that yelled at them, so I'm not surprised when they don't want to talk to me. And I feel kind of bad that I yelled at them yesterday. But that whole thing is a kind of illusory. There was a yelling event that was based on an intention, and that has an effect. But this idea that there's a continuous self that receives the results of the intentional action, that's the illusion. So we have some Zen stories about this, like in one of the Zen koan commentaries about karmic consciousness, a monk asks this Zen teacher Yunnan, he quotes the treatise on the flower ornament sutra, which says, "The fundamental affliction of ignorance is itself the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas. This principle is most profound and mysterious, extremely difficult to comprehend." This principle that the fundamental affliction of ignorance, like basic, like being totally caught up in this belief in the self and karmic effects coming back to the same self. That's, you could say that's the fundamental affliction of ignorance. But that itself is the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas, the wisdom that's free from these illusions. And so this monk quotes that and then says, this is extremely difficult to comprehend. And this teacher Yunnan says, actually, it's most distinctly clear and it's very easy to understand. And I'll demonstrate. So there was a boy sweeping the temple hallway nearby, and he said, Yunnan said to this monk, watch, I'll demonstrate. And he called the boy, hey, you. And the boy immediately just turned his head. And Yunnan said, is that not the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas? that like wasn't a karmic event. It was just pure response, spontaneous meeting of a call by turning the head. Perfect Buddha activity, so pure and clear, no problem, just immediate activity. Actually, free from suffering, we could say. You know, at that moment of the boy turning his head, there's no problem there, right? And then Yunnan asks, what is your Buddha nature? And the boy starts flustered and bewildered, doesn't know what to say, and he kind of just walks away. And Yunnan says, is that not the fundamental affliction of ignorance? So there's just the immediate response, no karma based on belief in an individual doer. Like, you know, like, I think I should turn my head now, or maybe I shouldn't, should I? Or maybe that would just be like, oh, I pretend I didn't hear him. Or, you know, that's all, that's suffering. Right? But like, boom, just free, spontaneous response. And then what's your Buddha nature? We start thinking karmic activity. I better give the right answer to the teacher or he'll think I'm stupid. And now this boy who is just so perfectly demonstrating Buddha wisdom is now totally suffering and caught in all his conceptual ideas and has to just run away. So just like that, it can turn from immutable knowledge of all Buddhas to fundamental affliction of ignorance. As the treatise says there, you know, one person is both of these. We're constantly going back and forth. We can let go of that that belief in the endurership at any moment and be free. So this, of course, ties into this question of free will. So kind of controversial topic, but, you know, and as someone who hasn't studied a bunch of Western philosophy, I just looked these up in Webster's dictionary. And I think I like, you know, the straightforward definition. Free will means the freedom of humans to make choices that are not determined by prior causes or by divine intervention. So we don't talk about divine intervention so much in Buddhism, but we definitely talk about prior causes. So if we go with that definition, that it's the freedom of humans to make choices that are not determined by causes and conditions, it doesn't look like there's free will in the view of Buddha Dharma, because everything is determined by conditions. Particularly what we're talking about tonight, what we call intention. Volition is a mental factor that arises dependent on conditions, which is particularly what makes it not an independent self, because an independent self, if there were such a thing, means something that doesn't depend on conditions. So if there were an independent self, then maybe it would have free will. And in fact, it seems that that's what we believe as humans. We believe, I'm me, and I can decide what to do now. And I'm going to. Don't we think so? Sometimes we feel really kind of helpless, like, I feel stuck and I can't do what I want. But still, we're still the self that's stuck then, right? And we still can decide how to squirm around in this stuck position, at least. So, and that sense of free will, on the surface, sounds really great, right? It's like, don't we want to have free will? But The way I see it now is that it's kind of a burden to have free will. It's kind of like I have to decide my destiny, and it's all up to me. There's some burden in that. Even when it's like I won the lottery, what am I going to do with my $1 million? I still think it's a burden. If I have to decide, in a way, like anything, I have to decide. That's maybe a question that you can take home and contemplate, is if it feels like you have to decide or even can decide anything, do you feel a little bit of dis-ease with that very freedom of so-called free will to be able to decide? Okay, so now we have, I think often the opposite of free will is determinism. And people say, well, Buddhism's not determinism, right? Well, here's Webster's dictionary of determinism. A theory that acts of the will, occurrences in nature, or social and psychological phenomena are causally determined by preceding events. Sounds like the Buddha's teaching of dependent co-rising to me. Determinism. Now, determined by past events, so I think we maybe could put a little clause in here and say, if we mean strict determinism, which would be like I yell at a person means that they're not going to talk to me tomorrow, no matter what. Like, that's a fixed thing. Like, every time you yell at a person, it means they're not going to talk to you tomorrow. That would be like kind of strict determinism. Like, one karmic cause always leads to the same karmic effect. So Buddha Dharma is not like that, actually. Because we talk about dependent co-arising, it means there's many other conditions in here. Like that person won the lottery today. So now, even though you yelled at them yesterday, when they see you, they're like, guess what, I won the lottery, let me just tell you. So, you know, if they didn't win the lottery, they wouldn't talk to you. But since they did, they do. So we have this other condition in there that's, and, you know, is there winning the lottery a karmic effect? Maybe not. I mean, we could say it is a karmic effect of them buying the lottery ticket, because that was a karmic action that was necessary to win the lottery. But there were other factors too, like the person who drew that ticket out, that determination was not due to the buying of the ticket, right? If we said that, it would become like magic and weird. So the law of cause and effect is very like straightforward, almost like common sense. Does that make sense? So it's not strict determinism, like this cause always leads to this result, but this result always has this condition. Is one of its conditions. In other words, we could also say, any result arises dependent on conditions. Or as it says here in determinism, acts of the will and occurrences in nature and psychological phenomena are causally determined by preceding events. Particularly the acts of the will part. Because I think in Buddhism often we don't look at it so deeply. We think, well, there's all these causes and conditions, everything's happening. So that part's just dependent co-arising. But then within that, there's an act of will that's not determined by conditions. Right? There's within that, I can decide what to do. And conventionally speaking, you know, I mean, it does appear that way. But if we look deeper, right, what is that agent of free will? It's a mix of five skandhas, but particularly this mental factor called intention, which is itself conditioned by conditions that are also conditioned all the way back, beginninglessly. So there's no fixed agent that can, in the middle of dependent co-arising universe, there's like this one like free agent that has the choice to do what it wants. It's like, we think that, right? But if we look deeper, how could that be? It's like, there's dependent co-arising, but I'm the one exception. All of you are conditioned, but I can decide. Yes?
Is it because each person has their own set of conditions and circumstances and past actions that we react very much as individuals?
In different ways.
Five persons might experience the same factor, but each person's reaction is utterly different. And that gives the appearance of free will because this person just does.
Yeah, I think that helps create the appearance of free will, that it's different for different people. And you could say that's our fourth skanda, called karmic formations, is the kind of really individual. You know, we perceive colors and hear sounds pretty similarly with a little variation. And we, you know, we make conceptions, we put words onto objects in a pretty similar way. Our basic six consciousnesses work basically the same way. So, you know, four of our aggregates that make up a person are pretty much the same, but this particular aggregate called samskara or karmic formations is what kind of makes us unique. Like we're all conditioned in different ways, and it's very complex, and that skanda holds all these different unique mental factors. I mean, there's still, according to classic Buddhism, there's still a list of, like, you know, there's 75 mental factors, and all of us only have these 75 experiences, but there could be, you could multiply them by 75 and have many thousands, but the ratios and the way they come and go are unique to each person because of all our different conditions. Yes?
Two questions, but I can do them separate if you want. So where would it fit in if, let's say that I am a person who usually, like, yells at people, like in your example. And let's say that one day I start noticing that it's really hurtful to people, how I talk to them. And so I decide that I want to try to improve that, because I'm studying Buddhism and I'm thinking about right speech, right?
Yeah.
So then I think, okay, I'm going to really try not to yell, even though I tend to yell and my mom and dad yell, but I'm really going to try not to yell, and I'm actually going to be aware of holding back.
Yeah.
Where does that fit in this story?
Yeah, that's great, because that is an essential part of practice, which is why I say, like, to examine our, you know, in zazen and all day long, watch our volitional activity. Basically, we're not so much, technically speaking, we're not watching ourself doing things. We're just watching how intention arises, and we can even catch how it's conditioned. Oh, I want to yell at that person, and I see why, because I've trained myself to always yell at that person. But now, because I've heard the Dharma, which, guess what, having heard the Dharma is?
A condition.
Exactly. So, but how did that happen? Well, we ended up in a Zen center, Zendo, and we heard about conditions. Well, how did that happen? It's all karmic, cause and effect, right? Yeah, it was intentions based on intentions. So the very fact that we practice or we don't practice is completely conditioned. And this is, I think, one of the most awesome, maybe frightening, could be depressing, could be elating, depending on our conditioning, insights in here, is because Because we think, that's what we hear is like, well, you know, practice harder. And so, and then we get inspired to practice harder or whatever. Practice harder, you know, our idea of that. But it's all conditioning. So we can say, but I can decide to like make more effort, but not really. And yet we find ourselves, that's the thing about like Sangha and stuff, how it's just this amazing conditionality that we can like, Buddha Dharma kind of like feeds on itself, right? It's like once you get into it, then it starts conditioning you in this new kind of way. And you can say, well, how do we get into it? Well, it's karmic effect of various other things. We can see how we can look for the conditions, how we got into it, which are different for all of us. And then it has its own life. So even if somebody says, like, say the teacher says, like, you should make an effort to study your karma. And then you say, oh, now because they said that, I'm going to make an effort to do that. And but that's just the condition of them saying that. And why did they say that? Because they were conditioned to say that. And you could say, maybe we could say it goes all the way back to the Buddha. It's just started this this particular chain of conditioning. And then people just like, there aren't people doing it. You could say that all the lineage of ancestors wasn't people. It was just this chain of conditioning that has that works in a certain way and leads to certain results that, because it leads to often positive results, it has this very nice kind of conditioning effect. And then you can see there's other paths that lead to really like negative results, and they also have their conditioning effects, and people go down and down, and then to a certain point, and then maybe some little condition, you know, we hear these stories a lot. The deepest pit of suffering, people wake up. Sometimes it may work like that, depending on conditions. We're not in control. So, and I say, like, depressing because it could seem depressing because it's like, well, then I'm just going to, like, since I'm not in control, I'll just, you know, I'm going to, my kind of, like, trajectory on this path of Buddha Dharma is, like, I don't have anything to do with it. You know, and ultimately speaking, I think it's true, you know. And that could be depressing if it feels like, and, like, I don't feel so good about my practice or something. I'd like to do more, but I'm not in control. But the whole thing is like you can't outsmart conditionality, right? So we're not in control, but it may mean that like suddenly you'll be really inspired to like, you know, let go of something that's really hard to let go of or whatever. We never know. Yes?
Well, obviously it raises the question of responsibility.
Yes.
And the questions of guilt and reward and punishment.
Yeah.
Strong sense of condition if that truly is the case, but I am bewildered by that question of punishment, reward, guilt.
Yeah, well, this occurred to me too. So actually, that was the third word I looked up was responsibility, because it completely ties in here, right? Because if you say it's all determined, then who's responsible, right? So Webster's Dictionary says responsibility is moral, legal, or mental accountability. Accountability. So, also the word responsibility is kind of nice because it's like the ability to respond is the word. And so you could say in the, since there is accountability in these moral, legal, arenas, which are basically like human conventions. It's kind of like if we're, you know, like just like free will appears to be the case, we live in a world of people believing in free will. So, and we kind of agree to do that thing. even as Buddhist practitioners, we can't like step out of it. I mean, there are stories, right? Zen stories of people kind of like trying to, like they see through this, how society is this conditioned illusion, and they start doing crazy things. But often it doesn't work that well, right? So because it's like, so generally we kind of like, we go along with the conventions of like morality, for example, because that's what people, because people who believe, if other people believe that we're a self and we're responsible, then we go along with them. As bodhisattvas, we kind of like, I think that's what a bodhisattva is they're willing to play the game of appearing as sentient beings. Buddhas, in a way, they don't play the game anymore. Strictly speaking, right? A Buddha's like, I've done the bodhisattva thing long enough. I've played this game for countless eons, and I've woken many people up from the dream of this game, and now I'm just going to enter the non-game reality. But bodhisattvas are like, I'm going to come back and play the game again. It means like I'm going to go along with the laws of the land, and if I don't, I'm going to like go along with the consequences. It's kind of like if we're going to, you know, be born into the world of sentient beings, I think that's what it means. It's like then we go along with the effects. And you could say the freedom of the bodhisattva is by seeing the kind of illusory nature of it, they're willing to receive whatever effects come, because they see that, like, that's okay. Like, you mean I did this, so now I have to go to, like, jail for some years? It's kind of like, oh, okay. I'm willing to play that game, because that's why I'm here on the planet. That's it. I'm not going to, like, try to argue against conventional truth of this, of the world, of where, like, you're a person, and you're the same person, which is, ultimately speaking, it's not true. That the person that you're putting in jail is not the same self that did the crime, right? According to Buddhism, ultimately speaking, they're not the same person. Even the second after they did the crime, they're not. But the way the cause and effect plays out, it appears that they are, and bodhisattvas are willing to do it. Yes.
It seems like this distinction you're making between a response and an impulse is crucial. Like, if we can catch the moment before an impulse becomes an action, for example, in that whatever fraction of a second, we've given rise to a new set of conditions, and the response can live on the coattails, I guess I would say, of that new set of conditions.
Yeah, yeah. So in a way we're saying, like, practice, you know, the meditation practice, the practice of kind of slowing down, being calm and still enough to watch our experience. When the impulse comes, then we can have a fresh response that's not, it's not going to be the same response as our usual habitual impulse. So it's kind of like, by studying this, it's like retraining habits. And in a happy direction, generally. So it's great. And then you could say, on this deeper level, it's like, well, the decision to you know, sit down and be quiet to study this, we actually, you know, ultimately we can't really decide to do that. But the fact that, like, you mentioned it is one of the conditions in the room now. It's now here, like, oh, I'd like to do that. We keep, you know, we're like, and I know I don't really do it, but it leads to conventional happiness. So, like, let's do it. The Buddha, like, totally honored conventional truth. And, so then it's in, and then part of the thing too here, part of the way that these two different things tie together is like, the more we do this kind of conventional practice of just like, okay, let's make the effort to like be really aware and catch the impulse and therefore we're not going to react as strongly and habitually, and now we get more calm because we didn't act out, and now we'll get our life is getting more settled the more we do that, and then as it gets more settled and calm, the more deeply we see that, oh, this whole thing is not like I thought it was, you know. So, and I think that's a really important thing, principle of studying karma, is like you study conventional karma and how and wholesome and unwholesome, and you go in the direction of wholesome in order, you could say, to be happy, but also in order to like settle your life enough to see that this whole karmic thing is like not what we thought it was. And if you try to see this ultimate truth of like it's not what we thought it was before doing the conventional practice of doing the wholesome action of not acting out, I think it's impossible. That's the beautiful setup of how the Dharma happens to have arisen in this world, is that, does that make sense, how they go together? Like, I don't think you can just leap to seeing how it's all an illusion when you're kind of beating people up all the time. I just don't think, you know, theoretically you could, but practically speaking, it's virtually impossible because it's so disturbing to be beating people up, for example. Does that make sense? That principle, I think, is you know, it's probably not in the sutras, but I think it's really important link between conventional ethical practices as the basis for seeing that there actually, ultimately, there isn't good and bad at all. We hear that kind of thing from the ultimate perspective. These are conceptual ideas, but unless we really engage in trying to really do the wholesome action that leads to the good result, then we won't be settled enough to see that there is no, that good and bad are kind of made up. And if we see that good and bad are made up, and then we can see like, well, now we can go back to just doing whatever, I don't think that works either. Right? Because then it's the same problem. Then it's like acting from a self again. Yes?
We create a feedback loop by watering certain seeds in the storehouse consciousness that then grow and take up more space, supporting good action.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Next time we make a choice that's conditioned by what we supported, the seeds we watered.
Yeah. That's right. And so like, yeah, the Yogacara tradition, instead of calling it the fourth skanda of karmic formations with all these different mental factors arising and ceasing, they call it the storehouse consciousness, virtually the same as the fourth skanda. And they just call it that. It's basically a karmic, yeah, it's a karmic storehouse. And that whole process of watering the seeds that give rise to like nice flowers instead of painful flowers. We do that. Yeah, we do that. We intentionally do that. So we train ourselves in wholesome actions to make a beautiful field. And when the field's really beautiful, then we can see that it's not a field. So we can't skip that step. But in the end, the karma and even rebirth that we didn't even get into, those are like conventional teachings that in the conventional world, they seem to really hold true. Rebirth is just another version of cause and effect. But there's no, from the ultimate perspective, there's no coming and going. There isn't arising and ceasing, not to mention an independent self. Yes.
With respect, I cannot see myself as hydroponic garden. So, but I can see myself as an initiator of cause. The child was born in 1948 in Georgia, and he's conditioned by others to hate and to be afraid of certain kinds of people. grows up and his schoolmates all raised the same way and they go beat up that kind of person.
Yeah.
That's, in my view, not karmic. But as soon as, let's say I'm that person, as soon as I do what Jean was talking about, and you, and I say, I can initiate a cause. I can accept the initial conditions of my nurturing. I was raised to be a bigot. And I think I'm going to initiate a different response because I heard these people talking who were dressed in strange clothes and they said I could do that. That's the beginning of karma.
Yeah, and the appearance of free will, like it seems like there's the choice to do that. It's just if we look deeper, we see that it was dependent on having heard such a teaching.
Well, I understand all that, yeah. But there is a point where it is free in that I can freely form an intention.
Well, it depends what you mean by you can freely form an intention.
No, I mean exactly what I said. I can go with the crowd and beat up another guy. Or not. I am freely forming an intention.
Who is?
I am.
And who's that?
I don't want to go there.
That's what we're talking about tonight.
No, that's what I'm talking about. You know, if I had all the time in the world to sit on a cushion in a room, I could talk about that. But in reality, I'm in the world. And I can form an intention not to road rage the guy that just cut me off.
Yeah.
I can do that. So at some point...
At least you think it appears that you can, and that's the world we live in.
Well... You know what? It doesn't just appear if I get run over in the street. I know what you're saying, and if I sit quietly, I can find that, yeah, you know what, there is a technique I can follow that allows me to loosen up my fixed ideas and my reactivity in many, many, many circumstances. But I don't have to go all the way to say that truck that's coming right at me at 60 miles an hour blowing his horn doesn't really exist. I don't have to go there.
That's kind of a different step.
But I can say, you know, these are the conditions I have without attributing who's to blame or anything else, without, you know, paying for anything, and say, I'm going to initiate this cause and I'll be open to see what outcome there is. Without dictating an outcome. So that's the beginning, in my view, of karmic activity. And I think that's very important for me, because I think that is the essence of Buddha nature, is the ability to do that, as opposed to just be a bug. The ability to make an inappropriate action, in my view, is the very definition of Buddha nature, which also implies that I can make an appropriate action. So that, I think, is the beginning of karma.
Okay. So it's time to stop. I just will leave you with this one quote from Vasubandhu. Who created the variety of the world of living beings and the physical world? It was not some... creator with intelligent design. The variety of the world arises from the karma of living beings. The whole world arises from the intentional activities of human beings. And Buddha Ghosha says, no doer of deeds is found. No one who ever reaps their fruits. Empty phenomena roll on. This view alone is right and true. While the deeds and results roll on, all based on conditions, there no beginning can be seen, just as it is with a seed and a tree. So may this be encouragement for all of us to to really examine our body, speech, and mind activity, and our intentions in a moment-to-moment way, and may they evolve by the very karmic action of paying attention to them. May they evolve in a more and more wholesome way that is less and less harmful to others, so that eventually we can see that karma itself is an illusion. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are number